Hi, I'm Dr. Lakeland Hogan, gerontologist and caregiver advocate for Home Instead, and you're listening to Empowering Professionals in Aging, a podcast and webinar series presented by Home Instead and hosted by the American Society on Aging. This series was created for those who are dedicated to serving the aging population and who have a passion for learning. Working together, increasing our knowledge, and understanding the various perspectives of these issues will help unite professionals in our common mission to better serve older adults and the families who care for them. Throughout the series, we will cover a variety of topics, including medication management, end of life, technology, mental health, financial exploitation, and other important issues in aging. We hope you find today's episode enlightening.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. Thank you for joining us for today's webinar, Maintain Your Brain, Reducing the Risk of Dementia, presented by Home Instead and hosted by the American Society on Aging. And now I would like to welcome our presenters, Lakeland Eichenberger, who is a gerontologist and caregiving advocate for Home Instead, an honor company, the world's largest provider of home care. With a doctorate in gerontology from the University of Nebraska, she educates professionals, families, and communities on the challenges faced by older adults and available resources to help them thrive. Lakeland is a sought-after speaker on caregiving, contributing nationally and internationally, and serving as a media resource. Jenny Monroe is a gerontologist and response team manager for Home Instead's global headquarters, leading the Home Instead response team in helping family caregivers navigate the complexities of the elder care continuum. She is a certified Alzheimer's Journey Coordinator through Camden College. Lakeland and Jenny, we are so excited to have you here with us today.
Thank you, Victoria. Hi, everyone. Yes, Jenny, this is Lakeland's voice, and I'll pass it to Jenny in just a moment, but we are both so excited to be with you guys today. This kicks off our first webinar in our entire Empowering Professionals in Aging series. And so every month we do these webinars, we hope that you will continue to sign up for them. We have a variety of really interesting topics for this year. And today's topic is maintaining your brain, reducing the risk of dementia. And this is something that really can apply to all of us because we all have a brain and a smart one at that. And so there's a lot we all can be doing to protect our brains. And you're never too old or never too young to start thinking about our brain health and engaging in brain healthy habits. And so Jenny and I are presenting today, and here are our learning objectives. We want to review the risks of cognitive impairment later in life, understand why brain health is important across our lifespan, and then learn about the five pillars of brain health. And as always, we'll leave you with some support and resources towards the end of the webinar to help you on your brain health journey. So I'm going to pass it to Jenny, and she's going to start us off by reviewing some really important statistics and information on Alzheimer's and dementia, again, so we can kind of set the stage for why this topic is so important. So Jenny, I'll pass it over to you.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Lakeland. It's great to be here, and thank you to everybody that joined us. We're really excited to start off this year on a subject that's really important to all of us. It can be really helpful to understand the worldwide impact, not just here in the U.S., but here in the U.S., we have 6.7 million people living with Alzheimer's or some other related dementia. As some of us realize, Alzheimer's is the leading disease and the sixth leading cause of death. And about every 65 seconds, someone develops Alzheimer's disease. So some incredible numbers here. And the last one, 44% of individuals age 50 to 64 reported being worried about developing dementia, which that continues to rise as the disease continues to progress. As I mentioned earlier, it can be helpful to really understand these numbers worldwide and its impact, not just here in the U.S. Worldwide, there are 55 million people around the world currently living with dementia, and that number is going to be expected to grow by 139 million in 2050. So an incredible number there. and something that we want to educate everybody on and how to, you know, delay that risk and move forward. 40% of dementia cases can be prevented or delayed by addressing the modifiable risk factors that we will go to later in this discussion. So some of the risk factors for cognitive decline, some of the things that we can't control are our age, genetics, family history, and then we're also going to talk about modifiable risk factors. And then really what research is starting to understand is that there are certain risk factors that can increase the chances of a person developing dementia or Alzheimer's, which, as I said earlier, include the age, genetics, family history, environmental, and lifestyle. Age is really the greatest risk factor for late onset Alzheimer's, our older age. When it comes to genetics, there can be certain genetics or genes that can put a person at higher risk for some aging brain disease. However, the majority of these genes do not guarantee that you will develop the disease. Now, when it comes to family history, a family history is not necessarily for an individual to develop Alzheimer's. However, those individuals who have had a first-degree relative, meaning a parent or a sibling with the disease, are at higher risk. Now, when it comes to the modifiable risk factors, this is what we'll focus on today's presentation. Health-related risk factors are things like blood pressure control and making sure that we have a steady blood pressure, cardiovascular health management, tobacco prevention. If you are still smoking, it's never too late to stop smoking. Diabetes and prevention management, obesity prevention and control, injury prevention, and addressing hearing loss. So modifiable risk factors are often areas we can have control and influence. These are things that can help reduce our risk for cognitive impairment over the life course. One of these bullets here, the injury prevention, at first when we were putting the slides together, my first thing that came to mind was prevention injury and cognitive impairment, like wearing a helmet or wearing a seatbelt. But there are other things that we can do. One thing that came to mind is fall prevention and head injuries. You know, maintaining our flexibility and our strength and our core. Those are things that we can do to prevent falls and prevent injuries. Another important factor I thought too is managing our stress and our mental health, as well as sleep. Sleep is is one of the pillars of good health, and we'll go to that later in our slides as well. Give me one second. Did I miss a slide? I don't think so. There we go. Okay. So additional risk factors for caregivers. Some additional risk factors for caregivers. You can read the following list here on this slide. It's really important to understand that realities of caregiving could result in increased risk for cognitive impairment later in life and aging brain diseases. This isn't just for those that are caring with someone living with Alzheimer's, which could put you at a higher risk if the person you're caring for is a relative, but it also applies to other types of caregivers too. So those caring for someone with other neurological disorders or cancer caregiving, these are additional risks for caregivers, including family history of Alzheimer's could put a caregiver at higher risk, especially if it is caring for a parent or a sibling with Alzheimer's or another type of dementia. Increased stress and strain due to the role. Caregivers have a very high stress level. Alzheimer's and dementia caregivers are at an even higher risk of stress and strain than the average caregiver. The demands of caregiving limit time for self-care. So if you've ever been a caregiver, you know that your time and your self-care usually gets put on the back burner. Caregivers are often juggling a lot and they find it hard to engage in self-care and these brain health activities. own health care gets put on the back burner, as I said. We see caregivers make sure their loved one gets all their own health care appointments too, but fail to go on our own. And that can result in unmanaged health conditions like high blood pressure and diabetes that can increase your risk for cognitive impairment. Impacts to sleep, exercise, and eating habits. Caregiving can impact individuals' sleep, especially if you have a loved one that wanders at night. Caregivers can feel they don't have enough time for themselves to exercise, to cook healthy, and so they grab more convenience foods that aren't really good for the brain. And then more likely to be isolated. We all know the demands of caregiving and how it can impact the time for social interaction. So many talk about how friends and family pull away because of their caregiving situation. So you may not know how to act around someone living with dementia, and so they tend to isolate from themselves and others. We do know that caregivers are pressed for time. So as we go through this presentation, we can call out some small changes that caregivers can start with that will make a difference for their brain health. So with that, Lakeland, I'm going to pass it over to you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jenny, for setting the stage. And I think it's such a good reminder that, you know, again, we all should be worried about our brain health. But I think many of us in our professions, we work with family caregivers. And so being aware that their brain health is also so important, but also realizing that they have some of these potential, you know, constraints on their time and resources that may make it more challenging. So as we go through these six key areas of brain health, oh, I think I said five earlier. Well, I meant six. My apologies.
I think I said five. I might have said five. Sorry.
Well, there's never too many ways we can keep our brain healthy, so we'll go with six for today. But as we go through these key areas of brain health, like Jenny said, we're going to call out a few just kind of easy ways to get started, because you think about it, it can be overwhelming to engage in all of these at the same time, but there's little things we can do to incorporate these into our lifestyle. Then we can kind of maybe work up to all six over time, and we can also kind of evaluate which ones are we doing well, which ones can we have areas for improvement on. But as I said earlier, it's never too early or too late to live a healthy brain healthy lifestyle. And that really is true. Whether you are in your 20s, 30s, and 40s, you might think, well, why does my brain health matter? Well, what you're doing in that period of your life can impact your brain later in life. But if you're in your 50s, 60s, and 70s, you can also engage in these brain health activities that can have some great benefits. And even if you have a diagnosis of some type of dementia, these things, focusing in on these key areas can also still be good for your overall brain health. So we're going to go through these six areas: exercise, eating right, sleep and relaxation, social connection, engaging your brain, and managing stress. And I feel like sometimes these things seem obvious to us, but just because they're obvious doesn't mean it's easy. And so I'm going to offer up some just additional insights in each of these key areas, and then also some suggestions on how we can engage in these areas of brain health. So the first is to exercise regularly. And we all know that that is good for our overall health. We know that exercise, we've heard a lot, you know, exercise is good for your cardiovascular system, it's good for your heart, but what we're now finding is what's good for your heart is good for your brain. So exercise has multiple benefits. We know that those who exercise have a lower risk of developing cognitive decline over the life course, and there are so many great benefits for exercising the brain. It improves our blood flow, it reduces inflammation, and it can lower those stress hormones as well. And so sometimes it's hard to know, okay, what kind of exercise, how much exercise to do. And the American College of Sports Medicine, they recommend 150 minutes of exercise per week. So if you break that down, that's just about 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. But of course, you know, more is better. And if you can get a little more, great, but this seems to be the sweet spot. So, you know, you want to also switch it up, keep it interesting, do activities that you enjoy, but you can incorporate aerobic activities like walking, biking, swimming, along with strength training like lifting weights, Pilates, yoga, resistance bands, but also balance exercises like yoga and Tai Chi. They're great to incorporate into your exercise regimen and also can help with reducing that fall risk that Jenny mentioned earlier. And so, again, if you have never exercised before, it's important to touch base with your healthcare provider before starting a new exercise routine. But again, finding one that works best for you. And some people like to work out individually. Some like to have an accountability partner or go to like a group workout setting. And so, again, if you find that it's hard to just get started, I always suggest, you know, walking is a great way to get started. It's free. You can do that in most areas of the country right now. It's nice enough weather to do that. Maybe those that are in the colder climates, maybe you hop on a treadmill this time of year. But getting out to walk could be a great place to start, especially for family caregivers. Maybe it's just going for a walk around the block could be a great way to get started exercising, or even just, you know, on YouTube or on the internet. There's so many great free workout videos or yoga videos, and they're all different lengths. So even just a 10-minute yoga or stretching video could be a great way for a caregiver or anyone to get started on this area of brain health. All right, so the next one is eating right. Again, this is something that we've probably heard about over and over. It's important to eat right. It's good for your health. Well, it's really great for fueling your brain. And research has shown that the Mediterranean style diet may be the kind of the diet makeup that's best suited to reduce our risk of cognitive decline. And so this type of diet is made up of, you know, whole grains, green leafy vegetables, fish, olives, nuts. There's a lot of, you know, great recipes that you can look up that kind of adhere to this Mediterranean diet. And again, research is starting to show that this type of diet could reduce your risk of cognitive decline later in life. And just like exercise, you know, you want to be sure to consult your healthcare provider before making big drastic modifications to your diet. But again, it's important to eat healthy. And so some tips for eating healthy, brain healthy, you know, there's no one silver bullet. There's no one food that can improve your brain health. You know, we see a lot of studies like eat blueberries or coffee is good for your brain health. No, coffee is not good for your brain health. There's a lot of conflicting information out there. So there's not one kind of single magic food that we can eat or eat a lot of or avoid that's going to guarantee our brain health. But we know that we can limit red meat and foods that are high in saturated fats and instead choose more lean meats and cook with, you know, olive oils, those types of things. We can also reduce our sugar intake, especially those store-bought sweets, which I admit I'm a sucker for. But if we can choose our sweets wisely, maybe try for homemade baked goods or opting for a dark chocolate that has a higher cocoa content, that can be just a small modification we can make to improve our brain health. So some additional tips, you know, adding fish. I know not everyone's a fish person, but there's other foods that are rich in omega-3s as well that you could add. You know, load up on fruits and vegetables, especially berries and leafy greens. Try to make your plate really colorful. You know, also sticking to whole grains such as oats, barley, quinoa, and also adding in spices like turmeric, cinnamon and ginger to enhance the flavor of your food, and then you can enjoy some brain health benefits as well. And then also hydration is so important for the brain. Our brain needs, liquids, lots of liquids. Of course, water is great, but there's fun ways you can kind of spice up your water with different flavors to motivate you to keep hydrating. We also know that coffee has some benefits along with black and green teas in moderation, as well as red wine or red grape juice. So it's not, again, like you have to kind of uproot your whole eating habits, right away. But again, there's can be little things you could do to incorporate some healthier eating habits. And if you're busy, you're on the go, maybe you're a caregiver, you could start small with, having some fruits and veggies cut up and washed. I like to do that right when I get home from the grocery store. I like to wash my carrots and my celery and chop them up and put them in a container in the fridge. And also, slice up my strawberries and wash my blueberries and have them ready to go. That way, when I open the fridge, when I'm hungry, I'm more likely to grab them out and eat them when they're already prepared, as opposed to looking at, the celery and saying, well, gosh, I'd have to wash it and clean it before I eat it. I'm just going to opt for some chips. So again, for me personally, that's one way I make it a little easier on myself to incorporate some more fruits and veggies. You could also have, groceries delivered too if you're a busy professional or a busy caregiver. That way, you might be strapped for time, can't get to the grocery store, but having your groceries delivered could just cut down on one more errand that you have to run. Okay, so the next tip is all about sleep and relaxation. And I am a new mom. I have a little 3-month-old at home. And so this area sounds like a dream to me right now. My sleep is not great. But what is the good news is, hopefully my sleep will return and it will have, continued brain health benefits for me down the road. But it is so, so important. And I'm experiencing how it impacts the way I function when I don't get good sleep. So I can feel my brain being a little more sluggish on nights where my kiddo is up and I'm up through the night. So why is this so important for our brains? Well, when we are sleeping, it helps the body with recovery. We're able to flush toxins out of our brain. It can help our body heal tissues. It can help consolidate and strengthen our memory. And it can also improve learning. And so while we're sleeping, all of this good stuff for our brain is happening. And there's kind of this myth out there that, if I lose a lot of sleep during the week, well, I can just catch up on the weekends. And while, taking an extra long nap on the weekend might feel good, it really is not a great substitute to getting a quality night's sleep night after night. So that really should be your goal, is to create a consistent sleep routine. And I have some 10 quick tips on secrets to slumber. And that's the first one, is stick to a schedule. Try to wake up at the same time every day, even on the weekends, and try to go to sleep at the same time each day. It kind of helps your body get in a routine. And prioritize your sleep as much as possible and create a sleep hygiene routine. And what that means is when you're getting ready for bed at night, create some sort of routine for yourself. Maybe it's sipping a cup of hot tea, turning off all your electronics, and kind of winding down. Or maybe it's reading a book for a few moments, just to calm your brain, your body. Or maybe that's when you choose to do your Tai Chi or your yoga or your meditation right before sleep. But creating some sort of routine that triggers to your body, okay, it's time to wind down and get ready for bed. It can also be helpful when you're waking up to wake up to early morning light. And again, avoid daytime naps or long naps if you can. And another great benefit of exercise, that's the next tip is to get moving, is it will help you sleep better at night. And I know that to be true of myself. If I'm able to exercise that day, I often sleep so much better. So you'll see some overlap in these these tips for brain health and how, you know, exercise can be great to help you sleep and that sort of thing. And also watching what you eat and drink, speaking of, you know, mutual benefits, you know, try to avoid caffeine later into the day. I kind of have a rule for myself. I try not to drink caffeine after about 1 p.m. because I just know for my body that it will prevent me from sleeping well that night if I drink caffeine in the afternoon. Again, you know your body best. But if we're eating healthy, if we're hydrating well, then it can help us have a better night's sleep. Also, you might want to review your medications. Sometimes there are side effects to some medications that can impact your sleep. So if you're especially noticing changes in your sleep after starting a new medication, you'll want to make sure to talk to your healthcare provider about that. You also want to create an optimal sleep environment. A cool, quiet, dark environment can be the best for optimal sleep. And that includes eliminating electronics. And sometimes even the light from your nightlight or from your alarm clock can prevent you from getting a good night's sleep. So one, you know, quick kind of tip to get you maybe started on this path to better sleep is using a sleep mask. That eliminates all of the extra light and could help create a darker environment for you. Also, I love to have a sound machine on. It, like, at night, it just kind of helps drown out any ambient noise that might be. I live close to a highway, so it kind of just helps create a relaxing environment. So you could do that as well. And I also mentioned earlier establishing those bedtime rituals. And getting, again, a good routine down in the evening to wind down. And then also know the poor warning signs of sleep. We see many people, especially as people get older, they feel like they have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep. Maybe their partner snores or they snore. So it's important to address those issues with your healthcare provider to make sure that you're addressing those warning signs of poor sleep, and so that you can prioritize your sleep and get the most out of each night's rest. Okay, so the next in our key areas of brain health is social connection. It is so, so important for us to be in connection with others. And when we think about social connection, we can think about quality over quantity. So you don't have to have, you know, hundreds of social connections to get the benefit. You know, enjoying close ties with friends or family are great ways to have meaningful social activities that can contribute to great brain health. So we want to make sure that you're getting quality, meaningful connections for you. And so here are some tips that we can share. So again, focus on the relationships and activities that you enjoy most, and perhaps it's prioritizing those. Maintaining connections with people of different ages can have a lot of great benefits. That multi-generational social connection can be great for both age groups that are interacting. Also, staying in that regular connection with relatives, friends, and neighbors, maybe it's creating some sort of, you know, weekly Sunday night dinner as a family, or every Wednesday night you call and check in with a family member or friend, kind of creating that regular connection. And then look for opportunities to pass along skills that you have. So maybe it's cooking a meal for someone else and sharing it with them. Maybe it's engaging in volunteering, or maybe you're tutoring a student. Again, if you're able to share something with another person, what a great way to connect. You can also try out organized clubs or activities. I mentioned earlier, you know, if you like to exercise in a group setting, again, great benefits for both your physical health and your social connection, making those connections in an exercise class, or maybe you want to join a book club or a travel club. And then humans aren't the only people that make meaningful connections. Our pets can be a great source of loving relationships, too, and can have great benefits to us in terms of our social connections. All right, so we have two more areas left. This next is to engage your brain. If you've heard of that kind of phrase, if you don't use it, you lose it. So we want to make sure we're continuing to engage our brain because we know that a cognitive reserve can develop over time through education and learning and curiosity. And so that can be really good for our brain health. We do know that if you look at studies, higher education levels can reduce the risk of cognitive decline. But I'm not saying go back to school. I'm not putting that message out there. We can still learn at any age. And so, again, being curious, learning, trying new things, it can help to create more of these neural networks and help our brain manage any potential failures or declines that it faces over time. So it can be just really, really good for our brain to continue learning. So here are some small ways you can do that. You can even just switch up your routine. So if you always brush your teeth before you wash your face, switch it up a little bit. Or if you always drive the same route to school or to work or wherever you're headed, maybe take a different route. Just switch things up a little bit. We also know learning a new language, while that seems ambitious for a lot of folks, it can be really, really good for your brain. So are the arts. So musical instruments, painting, sculpting, dancing, those can be great ways to, again, get your creative side going, but also keeping your brain engaged. You know, work and volunteering are other great ways to engage your brain. If you think about it, if you're working or volunteering, you're probably solving problems or creating processes, so you're working your brain, but you're also typically doing that with other people. So it combines that social connection with engaging your brain. So double bonus there. Also playing various types of games. You know, many, you probably see advertisements for brain games, and those can be good. You know, playing chess, word find, playing card games like bridge, those can be good. I would encourage you to play a variety of games, you know, not maybe just sticking to one, the same game every single day, maybe switch it up a little bit. And then you could take a class at a community college or online to, again, maybe study a subject that you've always been interested in or explore something new, a great way to engage your brain. And engaging in a class like this, what a great way to continue learning. So I hope, again, you'll continue to sign up for our webinar series and continue to learn. All right, so the final key pillar of brain health is managing our stress. And we live in a world that's full of a lot of stress, especially if you're working, if you have a family, if you're working and caregiving. There's a lot of things that can bring us stress. We know stress is a given, but how we react to that stress and manage that stress can impact the brain. If we allow ourselves to have chronic stress, so stress over a long period of time, it can do damage to the brain through cell death and shrinking of areas of the brain that can involve memory and mood regulation. So it's so important for us to be on top of this stress and try to de-stress as often as possible. And so some tips on how we can do this, focus on the present. It can be helpful kind of to journal or keep a list of what's bothering us so it's not something we kind of ruminate on over and over. We also need to give our brain a break from time to time. We can focus on our breathing. You know, just taking a few moments to do three deep breaths, especially in a moment of high stress, can be so good for our brain. It can help to lower that stress hormone in our body by taking some deep breaths. Also, we can practice saying no, which is very hard for me to do a lot of times. You know, we can try to take a few things off of our plate to de-stress. Sometimes it's also helpful to use imagery when we're trying to de-stress, you know, to kind of go to your happy place. Maybe you think of your favorite vacation spots. You close your eyes, you're taking some deep breaths, you think of the beach or you think of the mountains. That can help to kind of calm you down in a moment of stress. Also, thinking positively and focusing on gratitude can be really helpful. I was just talking to somebody the other day that had read a study on how if you are in a moment of anxiety, if you start to think about gratitude, that can help replace those feelings of anxiety. So if we can focus on gratitude, maybe you journal it or just think of things in the moment that you are grateful for, it can help to de-stress. Also, allow events to unfold naturally. A lot of times, I like to call it pre-suffering. I do this a lot. I'm worrying about the future and things that I can't control. But if I were to just, you know, focus on what I can control and let that problem unfold naturally, then I can address any issues that come up as they happen instead of pre-suffering and thinking way too much about it. And also focusing on the specific problem at hand, kind of one thing at a time, can help. And then, again, if we're thinking about how these tips kind of cross over from one to another, things like yoga, tai chi, exercise can help to also manage our stress. I know sometimes when I'm really stressed, it helps me to go for a vigorous walk. Or I used to be a kickboxer. Not so much anymore, but I remember that hitting that punching bag was so therapeutic. But there's other times when that yoga or that meditation or breathing exercise helps me to de-stress in the moment. So you have to kind of find what works best for you, but don't let that stress get to a point where it becomes chronic and so that you can manage it over time. And sometimes you need to seek professional help. I have done counseling over the years to address my anxiety and a lot of things that I have learned have helped me to address that and to de-stress. So again, it can be very daunting to take all of these six pillars and get started right away. We just entered a new year. A lot of people make resolutions. And how many of you made a resolution on January 1st and now we're on February 7th and whoops, that resolution has kind of gone by the wayside. So we don't want to be too overly ambitious here and say, yes, I am going to do all of these six pillars exactly right starting tomorrow. We can make slow changes throughout our daily lives and create more of a lifestyle, a brain healthy lifestyle through these various pillars. And we know that it takes time to make a new habit. 21 days can help you get into a habit or break a habit. So maybe you just start with that mini goal. Okay, I'm going to focus this month for 21 days on exercise. I want to incorporate that 150 minutes throughout my week. Or maybe you even start with 50 minutes throughout the week and then work up to it eventually. So again, don't feel like you need to do all of these six pillars all at once. Take it at a pace that's comfortable for you. And why again do we talk about this importance of brain health? Well, we want to reduce our risk for dementia, for Alzheimer's disease, and other cognitive impairment, neurological disorders later in life. And I think it's important for us to also, while we talk about brain health, to talk about the signs of Alzheimer's disease so that we can address that in ourselves and in others. And so these come from the Alzheimer's Association. There are 10 signs of Alzheimer's disease. So we know any sort of memory loss that disrupts daily life, that is cause for concern. You know, we're all probably going to misplace our keys. We're all going to forget names from time to time. But usually, eventually, we can recall those names, or we eventually remember where we put the keys. But if you no longer can recall those or forget what the keys are even for, that is when it becomes an issue and needs to be addressed. Also, challenges with planning or problem solving. You know, I've talked to a number of individuals that have Alzheimer's or another type of dementia, and a lot of them had noticed, especially if they were younger, that they had changes at work. They couldn't keep up in meetings. They couldn't make the numbers on the spreadsheets add up. They couldn't plan or solve problems like they used to. And so that is a sign that something's going on and we need to seek out an evaluation by a healthcare provider. Same with difficulty completing familiar tasks. You know, if you have a loved one who's made the same side dish every year for the holiday gathering, but now it's tasting different this year, or as they're making it, they can't recall the ingredients or the measurements when they used to be able to, you know, do it by memory. Those kinds of difficulties completing familiar tasks could be a sign. Also, confusion with time or place. If you've seen that movie Still Alice, it's about a woman who has developed early onset Alzheimer's. She goes for a run and she does the same route of her run every single day. And all of a sudden, one day she finds herself not knowing where she is. And so she had confusion with the place that she was in when she for years knew exactly what the route was. And so that can be a sign. And also trouble understanding visual images and spatial relations. You know, if you start to see the person have difficulty with balance or walking, trouble reading, that could be a sign. And so here's the last of those 10 signs. If there's new problems with words or speaking and writing, maybe they're constantly searching for the right word or substituting them or describing the word instead of saying the word, that could be a sign. Misplacing things and losing the ability to retrace steps, we kind of mentioned that already, you know, the car keys in the freezer, that sort of thing. Also, decreased poor judgment, that can be an early sign. A lot of times we see this show up in financials. So somebody might not be able to balance their checkbook. They might be making really weird financial investments or giving to every single charity that sends them a mailer and they didn't typically do that. So that can be an early sign. Also withdrawing from work or social activities. You know, they might start to notice changes in themselves and don't want other people to notice. So maybe they start to miss out on their weekly book club, or they don't, they say, oh, well, I don't like, getting together with the guys for coffee anymore. It's just, it's not convenient, those kinds of things. You know, if they're starting to avoid things that, social activities that used to really bring them joy or fulfillment, that could be a sign. Same with changes in mood or personality. I listened to a lot of podcasts. I've talked to a lot of people living with dementia, and in one case, the husband was having drastic mood swings, and the wife was, you know, perplexed. She couldn't figure out why. They almost separated and got divorced. But they started to dig in from a medical perspective and realized that it was dementia. They got a diagnosis, and it was able to kind of, it was kind of a relief for their marriage. There was an answer to why the mood changes and the personality changes were happening. And so, you know, when we talk about these signs, if there is one sign that shows up, and it happens from time to time, that might not be as big of a concern as if any of these signs are showing up consistently over a time. And not everyone that, you know, develops Alzheimer's or another type of dementia will maybe have all 10 of these signs. But if, again, if you're starting to notice a few of them and you're starting to notice them over time, then it's really important to get a diagnosis, because we know the earlier we can detect these aging brain diseases, Alzheimer's, dementia, the more time we have for proper diagnosis and planning. And what we can do for our brain health at any age is to take advantage of regular cognitive screening. That can help determine a baseline for us. So Medicare, if you're Medicare eligible, every year you qualify in your annual Medicare wellness exam for a cognitive screen. And so you could encourage your loved ones to take advantage of that. Talk to the doctor about how you want to start that cognitive screen. Talk to your doctor about your brain health so that you can have, again, that baseline. And then if there's any changes from baseline over time, we can hopefully, you know, address it earlier on. It's also important to bring up these signs and symptoms to your healthcare provider, because it could be something other than dementia. It could be, for example, a urinary tract infection. We see a lot of times people have, symptoms of dementia or Alzheimer's that happen really quickly in cases of UTIs. Also, sometimes it's a vitamin deficiency, or again, if you started a new medication and right after you started the medication, you're starting to notice these signs and symptoms, it could be related to that medication. So another reason we want to get on top of this early is because it might not be a type of dementia. It might be attributed to something else. But in cases of diagnosis, if we can diagnose early, it allows time for us to plan in areas of legal and financial and planning for our care, and also ensures that we are making the voice of the person with dementia known. We want to know their wishes. We want to make sure that they're carried out, and we want to do that while they're still able to contribute to those conversations. And also, it helps get the individual to a specialist. Maybe they have the opportunity to participate in a clinical trial, because we know there's some great progress being made in terms of medication and treatment in the area of Alzheimer's and other dementia. And I also think it's really important to reframe a diagnosis. There's a lot of myths out there, you know, that life ends after a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or other dementia, and that's just not true. Many people can continue to find meaning and purpose. Yes, a diagnosis is scary, it can be hard, but you can still live life after a diagnosis. Also, there's a myth out there that, you know, if I have dementia, I'm going to end up in a facility or a nursing home. And actually, you can create a really safe and supportive environment in the comforts of home, especially if you're able to plan ahead, to make sure the house is set up for success, to bring in outside care and delay or even prevent having to end in a facility or nursing home. Also, there's a myth out there that, you know, caring for someone with the disease will be impossible and overwhelming. And yes, at times, it is really, really hard. But there are so many great resources and supports out there to help people along their caregiving journey. So it's important to make sure that we're connecting caregivers with those supports and resources. And I want to kind of start wrapping up here. I have a few more slides, but again, there's life after a diagnosis of dementia. People can live well. We need to surround them first with supports to help them do that. We can provide opportunities for them to engage in clinical trials or to become an advocate. The individual can still make goals and plans for the future. You know, create kind of that bucket list and start to check things off, and give the individual something to look forward to. Many people also start to explore new hobbies after a diagnosis. For example, a lawyer who was always kind of, you know, very formal and professional, after a diagnosis of Alzheimer's might discover that they have a passion for painting and for the arts, and that can bring a lot of fulfillment. And there's also a lot of ways and strategies out there to help people maintain their independence even as they progress through the disease, so we can continue to focus on their current skills and abilities and not necessarily on what is being lost. And in this picture on the slide is Dr. Cynthia Hewling-Hummel. She has been living with Alzheimer's disease for a number of years, but she has really leaned into living well with dementia. She lives alone still and very independently. She has really leaned into the arts. Behind her is a series of masks that she has created to explain the different emotions of having Alzheimer's and dementia, and she takes this exhibit to communities and talks about what it's like to live with dementia, but what it's like to live well. And so there are people out there that can be that support system, that can be encouraging to those that are living with a diagnosis. And then finally, I wanted to end kind of wrapping it back up to that conversation around caregivers. I think when we talk about brain health, we don't necessarily talk about how this can directly impact caregivers. And earlier, Jenny and I shared how caregivers could potentially be at a higher risk of developing cognitive impairment later in life just because of the nature of caregiving. So we need to help support them. So we can encourage them to prepare the person's home and living environment to set them up for success. So there's things out there like the home safety checklist, and these are clickable links. So if you download the slides, which you can do on your screen, you can get links to HomeInsight has a great free home safety checklist. We have home safety videos. We have a home care solution guide. There's a lot of information out there about the diagnosis and care tips. So no matter what type of caregiving the person's doing, there's so much that resources that are out there for caregivers, but a lot of times people just don't know that they exist. And also we can encourage caregivers to plan ahead for future care needs. They can join support groups or Facebook pages. There's great online communities. And then also we can encourage them to prioritize self-care, which can be easier said than done. But again, self-care could also be really great for their own brain health down the road. And so I wanted to leave everyone with some resources. HomeInstead's website has some great resources. I also host a podcast. It's called Caregiver Chats. You can search for it on Apple or Spotify. Talk about a resource and community for caregivers. That's the goal of my podcast, is to provide those for caregivers. There's also a brain guide, brain assessment tool on mybrainguide.org, and that is an initiative of the Us Against Alzheimer's organization. And what's great is if you're kind of on the fence, like I might be experiencing changes in my own cognitive decline, or I'm noticing changes in my loved one, on that website you can go and fill out a questionnaire, and it can kind of give you some information like, yes, your concerns are valid. You're encouraged to make an appointment with a healthcare provider, or, you know, these changes might be kind of normal part of aging, maybe continue to monitor them, that sort of thing. And they also have great resources. HFC, which stands for Hilarity for Charity, they have a Brain Universe course on their website. That organization was started by the actor Seth Rogen and his wife, Lauren Miller Rogen. They have great resources on that website and great support networks, including online support groups for family caregivers. The Cleveland Clinic has some great information on healthybrains.org. The Us Against Alzheimer's group and the Alzheimer's Association has great tools and resources and information on their respective websites. And then not everyone has Alzheimer's disease. We didn't really talk about how Alzheimer's differs from dementia. And dementia is really an umbrella term that describes a series of symptoms associated with things like cognitive decline, memory loss, and then there's different types of dementia that kind of sit under that umbrella. And Alzheimer's disease is the most common, so that's why you hear about it the most. But there are other types of dementia, like frontal temporal degeneration or frontal temporal dementia and Lewy body dementia. And there are two great organizations out there that focus specifically on those types of dementia. So I always like to share their resources. So it's the Association for Frontal Temporal Degeneration and then the Lewy Body Dementia Association. Great organizations. And then there's also on an international level, there are two groups, Alzheimer's Disease International. They put out a World Alzheimer's Report each year, and actually this past year was all about things we can do to reduce your risk of cognitive decline, so you can go to their site and download that. And then the Dementia Alliance International is made up of individuals that are living with dementia and living well with dementia. So if you know someone who is living with the disease, you might suggest that they connect with that group, connect with others who are going through what they are experiencing. There's so much power in connecting with others, whether they're fellow caregivers, fellow individuals living with a similar condition that you are. There's a lot of sense of community there, and it feels really good to know you're not alone in those situations. So those are some great resources. I am going to open it up for questions. Of course, if you ever need to reach Jenny or myself, those are our email addresses. I'll just page back quick to this resource slide, leave it up there while we take a few questions. I know Jenny had to hop off early, so it's just me answering questions, and so I'll get to as many of them as I can. Somebody said, can you repeat the name of the podcast? And it's Caregiver Chats is the podcast. And so you can find the podcast on Apple or Spotify, whatever podcast app that you like. you can find it there. Also, can you repeat the name of the woman who created the masks? And her name is Dr. Cynthia Hewling Hummel, and she actually turned it into a book, and it's called Unmasking Alzheimer's. So if you Google Unmasking Alzheimer's and Dr. Cynthia, you should be able to find more information on her. Let's see. What else do we have? People are asking, hi, Victoria. Sorry.
No. I'm sorry. I just saw that there were a lot of questions related to healthy eating and dieting. And I think overall also just is it too late? Is it too late to start now? Is it too late if you're in your 60s to start making these changes, whether physical or dietary?
Yes, that's a great question. It is not too late. It's never too late. I think anything that we can do for the betterment of our brain health at any age is going to have benefits. Of course, the earlier we can start, the more time it has to be beneficial. But the reality is it's never too early, it's never too late. But also, there's no guarantee that even if we did everything right, we ate perfectly, we exercised to a T, we did all six pillars, there's still a chance somebody could develop the disease at the end of the day. So while just like all the risk factors, like maybe a family history, or maybe you have a gene that's linked to Alzheimer's, just like those don't necessarily guarantee that you will develop the disease. There's a lot we can do to prevent and reduce our risk, but there's still going to be a little bit of risk, of course, that we could develop it down the road. So it's never too late. You can make it a difference at any age. So I would say don't be discouraged if you're in your 60s and you think, I'm not doing any of this. Well, start today and start small in making progress towards your own brain health. And also, again, I would suggest start talking to your healthcare provider about your brain health. If it's a concern to you, make sure that they know that. So that's something that they can help you monitor. And if you're, again, of Medicare eligibility, make that part of your annual wellness exam. Let your physician know, your healthcare provider know, I want to take advantage of that cognitive screening each year so that we can monitor my brain health, because it's important to me. So again, I know that there's a lot of fear around developing dementia. You know, of course we want to reduce our risk and we want to avoid it, but there's no one thing we could do to fully prevent or avoid it, but there's a lot we can do to reduce our risk. So I hope that makes sense. And again, those six pillars, sometimes people ask me, okay, if I could choose one that I start with, a lot of healthcare professionals that work in this brain health space, they say exercise or just get moving can make a huge difference. So if you're able to be active throughout the day, you know, even if it's just getting up and walking around every hour instead of sitting at your computer for, you know, 8 straight hours, that can be, you know, one good thing you can do for your brain health. So I hope that helps to answer questions around that. Victoria, did you see any other themes in the questions? I'm trying to catch up here, but I know that you've been looking at the questions as they come in.
It's been a very engaged audience that we have. There were definitely a lot of congratulatory remarks as well for you, Lakeland, and growing your family. There were definitely also questions regarding, you know, how to engage the brain, which you already touched on a little bit there. But we are running out of time, and I feel so bad because we always get so many questions, which is wonderful. But I think you touched on pretty much everything in your presentation. And if not, then we also have your contact information and Jenny's contact information, so you can always reach out regarding any additional questions that you may have. But we are coming to time now, so I just want to say thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure having you today, and Jenny as well. We want to thank Homestead for bringing this webinar to our audience.
Thank you so much, everyone, for listening to this episode of Empowering Professionals in Aging, presented by Homestead and hosted by the American Society on Aging. For more information about Homestead, visit homeinstead.com.